G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 252nd World News. My name's Dick Newman. This will be a tough little tale to tell, and I'm sure to bugger it up. It's a matter of how much do I bugger it up. We won't know unless we get on with it.
Take a pinch of white man. Flop it up in black skin. Add a touch of blue blood. And a little bitty bit of red Indian boy.
Curly black and king kiss. Mixed with yellow chinkies. If you lump it all together, well, you got a recipe for a get along scene.
Oh, what a beautiful dream.
If it could only come true, you know, what we need is a great big mouse and pot. Big enough to take the world and all it's got. Keep it stirring for 100 years or more. Turn out coffee colored people by the score.
Yes, 1969 and Blue Mink looking for an end to racism. All we need to do is have plenty of interracial sex and just create one set of humans, I guess. Yeah, good luck. My dear listener, we have hit the Age of Enlightenment in Europe. This leads a podcaster of English history, fact and fiction into a quandary that kicked off with the Renaissance, and that didn't get much airtime. The Renaissance was huge and affected all of Europe, but how deep to go? Too deep and the podcast might never end. Too little and we don't understand the big changes to society. But we rediscovered the old Greek and Latin stuff, lots of which was written before baby Jesus turned out, and found that those guys were pretty smart. What we did with that stuff was to use the practical stuff like architecture, and with the philosophy we looked to reconcile the philosophy of pagans with the true knowledge that was religion. The Renaissance also tossed up a new philosophy in the form of humanism. It was the first non-religious thought in over 1,000 years for Europe. Guys like Erasmus were clever enough to come up with a form of humanism that did not offend the church, and in fact he defended the church against Martin Luther. Then Martin Luther's new form of Christianity sparked off a huge amount of theological bullshit. That sparked off further types of Christianity, like Anglicanism, Presbyterianism, and Calvinism, and Puritanism, and plenty more. Before that, we humans had a set of rules imposed by the church which would get you into heaven. That was the big deal. Now we're being told that perhaps that wasn't quite right, so you have to follow these rules now. But are these rules the correct rules now that there's more than one set? All we all really know is that the Anabaptists are surely wrong. On top of that, we then had guys like Copernicus and Galileo turning up demonstrating that the Earth, the absolute centre of the universe around which everything revolves, actually revolves around the Sun. For over 1,000 years, we had known everything there is to know about life, the universe and everything through the big book of magic. Didn't matter that most people couldn't read the thing or that there are plenty of contradictions. The churchy guys interpret it for us and also sort out which contradictory point applies to our individual case. They were guided by the invisible hand of God. In our day, the answer to life, universe and everything might as well be 42. If the big book of magic is wrong, then do we know anything at all for certain? It's the upside down and we're in it. Confusion reigns. That led to guys like Francis Bacon coming up with an empirical method of gaining knowledge. Your senses, observation and experimentation will lead to the truth. And for Bacon, once we really know everything, then that will be utopia on Earth. He thinks that if we can come up with one scientific method for gaining knowledge, then it will lead to that utopia. The end of sickness and famine will happen. This will be the big deal for upcoming British philosophers, empiricism. Then there was his mate Hobbes coming up with political theory. He was in a good place and time to work on this. Civil war's going on. For Hobbes, it was a clash between political theories, those of the king and those of parliament. He pointed out that Charles could not win this thing, not because God was on anyone's side or even resources like money, hard men and weapons. It was the opinions of the two sides on religion and politics. Rhetoric used against the king, leading to opinions on his use of taxation, conscription of soldiers and military strategy, led to the outcomes we got. That is war. But there's a new philosophical movement that has been formed. Meet the radical sceptics who are saying, okay, the big book of magic is wrong, so nothing at all can ever be known for certain. Anything you think you know can be subject to doubt, and if it's subject to doubt, then it certainly could be wrong. So true knowledge is unattainable. Enter Rene Descartes, who says, sure, Francis Bacon and his empirical idea won't help out on that basis. We can't trust our senses. We may see somebody we think we know, but as we draw closer, it turns out to be somebody else. We can mishear things. Lots of things smell of lemon, but they aren't all lemons, and so on. But Descartes has an idea that we can find truth by reason and logic. Thus starts the battle of the English empirical thinkers and the European rationalists. This battle is only good news for we humans, and it will be resolved eventually by a guy called Kant, who will unite the two nicely. But for now, it's battle, and in France we have René Descartes, who will come up with cognito ergo sum. I stink, therefore I'm spam. Oh, that might be a dodgy translation. I think, therefore I am. Francis Bacon didn't need to think about whether he exists. He can see, smell, taste, speak, hear. His senses telling me he exists. And if he's ever in doubt, he can just say to anyone, hey, mate, do I exist? They'll say, yeah, I can see you. Case closed. Descartes, though, does not trust his senses, so he starts to doubt things. Then he starts to really doubt pretty much everything. He's searching for something, anything, that we can all know for sure without doubt. He's doubting so much, he will doubt if anything exists, including himself. How do we know, my dear listener, that we aren't in the Matrix just waiting for Orpheus to come along and offer us the red pill, or the blue pill, I can't remember. For Descartes, who is wondering if the world is even real, it'll be his dreams that has him doubting his own existence. His dreams are very real. While he's dreaming, he doesn't even know he's dreaming until he wakes up. How do you know, my dear listener, that you aren't having an extremely long and very detailed dream right now? Descartes then is wondering if he's even real. If he can establish that, then he will have established a first principle, a true piece of knowledge. And a first principle can then be used as a solid foundation to build further knowledge. Now, I might be thinking about the Matrix, but Descartes thinking that there could even be something like a personal demon allocated to each individual human whose task it is to constantly fool you into believing that you and the world around you are real. Same idea, really. A complex computer program or a personal demon constantly feeding data into your brain, fooling you that the world you see, hear, touch and smell is real. Descartes will then say, all this thinking I'm doing, that's actually me. I'm doing the thinking. That computer program might be giving me a constant stream of data, but it's me who is processing the data. I'm capable of independent thought, so I must exist. I'm doing the thinking, so I must exist. Cognito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And you're saying, well, thanks for fucking nothing, Descartes. My life is no different. But Descartes has established a first principle, we exist. It even passes the radical sceptic test. What we learn from Descartes then is not so much that we exist, but the doubt test. The trouble is, lots of things are open to doubt, and that makes it easy for, say, conspiracy theorists. Anti-vaxxers will tell you the real rate of vaccination is, whatever, 10% or 20%. And the vast majority of people are on their side. They are anti-vaxxers. It's a bit difficult to tell them they're wrong and that the government information provided to us via the fucking media is right. governments and media are not always honest with us. You can find examples just about every day. They may further tell you the vaccine is actually death medicine designed to kill off old age pensioners, that blight on society. You can try reasoning with this, saying that pensioners are actually great for the economy. They spend everything they get, which provides jobs for others, and a lot of that pension just fills straight back to the government in taxes. You can also point out that pretty much all economies work on a population growth of 1.1%, so a mass killing of pensioners would fuck that right up. But having rejected the pro-vaccination argument, these people in conspiracy theories have thrown all their doubt on the pro-vaccination side and failed to doubt anything provided by the conspirators. The benefit to you, my dear listener, then, is to apply your doubt equally. Examine what you can, make a determination. Particularly examine your cognitive bias. One side of politics is always right, while the other side is always wrong. It is a very popular cognitive bias in democracies and extremely unhelpful. Descartes now knows he exists, but he could still be in the matrix. That is, he exists, but does the rest of the world exist? Does the entire universe exist? I exist, my dear listener, but are you real? Or are you just a subroutine of that complex program? Easy answer, but one that leads to another problem to be resolved. For Descartes, the world is real because God, that all-powerful, peace-loving lentils deity, would surely not allow demons to infect our brains constantly. There you go. Nice simple answer with that tiny little problem then. Does God exist? Descartes will need to prove the existence of God. He'll do that. He's Descartes. But we are not going down that rabbit hole because it is rather deep, and sadly, his proof that God exists is, as you might have expected, totally flawed. So we are back in the matrix with me doubting that you, my dear listener, exist. My point here is that Descartes wasn't trying to prove the Christian God exists, just an all-powerful God. The main point is that Descartes, with his method of doubt, has shifted the debate from what is true and what can I be certain about. The Christian truth based on revelation and church doctrine can go. We are each a human capable of reason rather than some kiddie who has to obey this fucking God guy. Churchy types will not like Descartes, but we do. Just before we let Descartes go, though, he had been writing a book on the Copernicus theory that the Earth revolves around the Sun. Descartes is ticking off on that theory. He says, yeah, it's real. That was interrupted by the Inquisition having Galileo in for a little chat, and Descartes smartly abandoned his book. Those hard men churchy types could still inflict a lot of pain to back up their magical ideas about the universe. I seem to be fixated on the moody blues lately. We left Charles' sister Elizabeth Stuart way back in 1639. Bernard of Saxe-Weimar, instead of marrying a daughter Elizabeth, decided to die. Rupert was in an empire slammer and Charles Louis in a Frenchy slammer, so, as usual, it was all going badly. At least Elizabeth has worked out that Charles in England is having too many problems of his own to be of any help. Charles Louis will be out of the slammer pretty quick and be off to England to see if Charles can help with the Palatinate. That's a bit desperate. Charles will be wondering if Charles Louis is going to make a bid for the English silly hat. Quite possible. William II of Orange will turn up to marry Princess Mary, and Charles Louis will stay home and sulk. Oh, he's not going to the wedding. Charles Lilly was shitty because he wanted William II to marry his sister Elizabeth, whom I've already said didn't want to marry anybody. She's too busy playing with Descartes. Elizabeth is focused on England right now. In the argy-bargy, Parliament will approve a manifesto which includes giving the Palatinate back, and the Scotties are set to follow. Nice timing because a big peace powwow is about to take place in Germany, with Charles promising to send an ambassador, and he will write, "We will use and employ all such force and power wherewith God has enabled us both by our own arms and the help and assistance of all our allies and friends to vindicate the honour, the public peace and redress of the injuries, usurpations and oppressions of our said dearest sister, nephews and their illustrious family." Yeah, sounds good, doesn't it? Elizabeth is pumped by this news, but really Parliament want to talk up war with Spain, the Habsburgs and Catholics generally. Elizabeth will start talks about returning to England and parliamentarians will be very pleased, making lots of bullshitty speeches. Charles Louis will bring Protestantism back to the Palatinate and then the whole of Germany. He will refresh and comfort the needful heart of that most noble, virtuous and magnanimous suffering Queen of Bohemia, His Majesty's sister, His Highness's mother, who is ever to be highly and tenderly regarded by this house, by this kingdom. Oh, crikey. Elizabeth will be back to being dead keen on England now, but that manifesto, now signed off by the Scottish too, will be printed. In the printed version, they will drop the Queen title from Elizabeth. Oh, the effrontery, my dear listener. It will be rage for Elizabeth, and the English trip is off. We'll have that peace powwow, nothing about the Palatinate coming out, but it will result in Rupert coming out of the slammer. 10 points to Charles's ambassador for getting that. Rupert will go to England to say, "Thanks, Uncle Charles." Now, things are hot for Queen Mary in England, calling the Irish Rebellion the Queen's Rebellion. That's what they're calling it, because she's Catholic, and that meant she was at risk. She can come into the Hague now as well. It's not only Queen Mary with Daughter Mary and Rupert coming in. Lord Digby has been impeached, so he's turned up, and Parliament will keep this up, bringing more and more refugees to Elizabeth. Tricky. Elizabeth and Fred Henry, Prince of Orange, might be united, but the Duchy States General are firmly anti-royalist. Elizabeth will have a proclamation issued in England. Anyone coming here on the run from Parliament will be promptly sent home again. I'm bound by obeisance to King Charles and I have a great love for Parliament. Queen Mary and her few retainers, about 300 of them, will be the guests of the Prince of Orange for a year, and they're all bloody Catholics. As our civil war gets underway, there are people who call for Elizabeth to return to mediate between the two sides. She's hot property. There have been plenty of poems and plays about her, but the common theme is that she is the Gloriana version 2.0. Both sides will issue pamphlets saying she'll be here any tick of the clock and will be on our team. Officially, she's gone to Team Parliament, while Rupert and his brother Maurice are fighting Parliament. Parliament, though, are sceptical, and there goes her pension to the War Fund. The timing on that was when Rupert joined the Royal Army. Queen Mary could make her exit from the Hague. They were sick of her anyway, so the deal was she can take ammo with her for Charles, and they would even escort her back to England. The escort will be led by Admiral Martin Harper Zoom Tromp. Yeah, I forget that middle name. Martin Tromp, that's what we call him. He was played by Rutger Hauer in the marvellous movie Admiral. He is one good operator. And the Prince of Orange stumped up the cash for the whole thing. Time for Elizabeth to hop into the marriage game again. She's looking for a man for Louise Hollandine, while Fred Henry's missus has her daughter Louise Henriette on the market as competition. Queen Mary will hop in, proposing Prince Charles for Louise Henriette. But she wants a military alliance that would include the duchies fighting for Charles. Fred Henry will knock that on the head immediately. Prince Charles's value is down with the Civil War, plus Charles, of course, has not yet paid the dowry on Princess Mary. Louise Henriette will be going to Fred William, Electoral of Brandenburg. Bugger, he was Louise Hollandine's top Tinder pick. In fact, they'd actually been a bit of an item. Fred William's guys were so against Louise Hollandine, they slipped something into his beer to make him sick and kept him in Berlin. Somehow, a message will get to Fred William that Louise Henriette is small, crooked, and pretty much a hunchback with resting bitch face. She isn't. Fred Henry and Amalia can put up a very beautiful dowry in any case, and the deal will be done. Worst news for Elizabeth, April 1645, and her dear little lad, Edward, has done the secret marriage thingy to Anne Gonzaga, who was 9 years older than him. She'd had a big old fling with her cousin, Duke de Guise, and said they'd been married. He said, no bullshit. She then got engaged to the Duke of Elbeuf. Here comes Edward for a bit of Gonzaga honeypot, and he wants to marry her. I'm pretty sure he didn't marry her for her looks. Edward was totally broke, but he was actually rather pretty. Edward, of course, had to convert to the true faith in order for the wedding to happen, despite Elizabeth saying any kiddie turning Catholic would be disinherited. Anne Gonzaga's dad was the Duke of Nevers and the Duke of Mantua. Louis XIV will provide the happy couple with plenty of pocket money so they can live in luxury in Paris. Well, for Edward, he can live in luxury in Paris for 17 years, then just die. But it's another blow for Elizabeth, a guy off the bloody marriage market. Back to now, though, and while Elizabeth had no idea about this marriage, Queen Mary certainly knew and encouraged it. Another Stuart becoming Catholic was good for her. Now, good news. After 3 years, Parliament will restore Elizabeth's pension and give her a pay rise. Not that good, because the payments will be irregular, reducing, and eventually stop again. We can move on to the Royalist defeat. Rupert will run away to France, while Maurice will come home to Mum. Just in time for another scandal. Brother Phil this time. Edward will eventually be forgiven, but not Phil. 20th June 1646, and Phil will be meeting with exiled Frenchy Lieutenant Colonel Jacques de Lepinay. Jacques had been working for Elizabeth, and they were very, very friendly. Jacques was quite the lad, a real banger of the lovely girlies. It was a fling with his master's mistress that had got him exiled. Jacques was good at the courtier stuff and a very good dancer. We know how that excites the ladies. Fred Henry gave him a company of horses to command. Jacques then made spare cash by teaching the horsey riding, fencing and manners. He will meet Elizabeth, who will make him master of the horse. He will get to visit the private rooms at Elizabeth's court, and before you know it, the talk is that he is banging both Elizabeth and Louise Hollandine. Yeah, that old mother and daughter thing. Phil feels the need to defend the family honour. On the night in question, Jacques will come in with Phil telling him to fuck off, and Phil will just ignore him. Later that night, Phil will be assaulted by two guys. One is Jacques. It'll be a bit of a duel. Next day, and Phil will turn up with seven mates, and a chase will ensue. Jacques will trip over a case of oysters, and Phil is straight in with a dagger in the back. Jacques will then cop a further seven stab wounds, one from each of the lads. Jacques will be carted off, but won't survive. Phil will try saying, oh, it was a nice fair duel. Yeah, nobody believes that, mate. So there'll be a summons from the court for our eight killers, but they're gone. Phil would become a mercenary and die in battle, age 23. The I'm Not Marrying Anyone daughter, Elizabeth, will write to her mate Rene Descartes about Phil and his inability to calm himself down. Rene will dedicate two books to Elizabeth. Now, that wasn't the first time Elizabeth wrote to Descartes about her brother's nature. Elizabeth and her mum will have a big dust-up about forgiving Phil. Mum Elizabeth is so hopping mad that young Elizabeth will be booted out of home. She's off to exile in Berlin. It would seem the only sad bit of this for her was that Descartes was still living with the family. She'll miss him. As for Descartes on the Phil thing, he says, well, we've got no free will, so it was inevitable. Fred Henry still has a war to fight. He will take Sass van Ghent, then move on to take Hulst. Great, That limits the Spanish access to the Antwerp port town. It's an important link for the Spanish supply train. Time for Fred Henry to move on to Antwerp. He's supported by 4,500 Frenchies. We'll all get nicely into position and bingo, stroke, for Fred Henry. Dutchy forces are stalled. Fred Henry can't speak. Frenchies will move off to take Bergues to help their objective of getting Dunkirk. Fred Henry will manage to get stuck into Antwerp, but his guys will say too late in the season, mate. Besides, the Frenchies want them to help him take Dunkirk, while Fred Henry wants the Frenchies to help him take Antwerp. Frenchies will just go and take Dunkirk anyway. The States of Holland will say, we need to make peace with the Spanish. States General will say, no way. Fred Henry then is in a difficult position. He'll be sizing up Antwerp to take while negotiating with the Spanish. States of Holland won't sign off on his military budget. They want peace. Meanwhile, the Frenchies are wondering what the fuck is going on with Fred Henry. He's become erratic. I'll let the Frenchies know what's going on. Senile dementia is what's going on. Frenchies are trying to convince him that he should not do a deal with Spain, but he's lost the plot. The army wants his lad William to take over the army. Fred Henry will refuse. Then he'll try to convince the States General that his Mrs. Amalia should take over. What, say the States General? A girlie? And not only that, but apart from you, Fred Henry, old mate, everybody hates her. Plus, she'd been an advocate for peace with the filthy Spanish. So fuck her. Amalia will do a deal with the Spanish and receive toys and cash in return. March 1647 and Fred Henry is dead. Young William was annoyed with his mum and the Spanish deals. She, in turn, won't hand over power. Two factions form, Team Mum and Team William. Now, the mum, Amalia's English policy is to be peacemaker. William's English policy is fuck Parliament. Neither of them matters, really, and we're back to Charles being arrested.
Him and your camp was a real piss and was very rarely stable. I dagger was a boozy beggar who could think you under the table. Say that you could out-consume William Friedrich Hegel. And Wittgenstein was a beery swine who was just as sloshed as Schlegel. There's nothing Nietzsche couldn't teach about the raising of the wrist. Socrates himself was permanently pissed.
A little bit there of the Philosopher's Song by Monty Python, where basically they dress up as a bunch of Australians and proceed to sing that every philosopher that mattered was just a pisspot. Now, Frenchies are still keen to prove that God exists, so let's turn to Blaise Pascal, a contemporary Frenchy philosopher of Descartes. I should say, he's more of a mathematician. He'll kick off with a fine argument that really caught on big time with Christians. He wants to tell you, my dear listener, that you are a rational human being. Therefore, even if you doubt God exists, you should act as if God does exist. For Pascal, there's no real downside, and the upside is an eternity in heaven. Further, he will point to the totally limited ability of humans to understand the world, the universe, and everything. Only something like God can understand it all. Therefore, to have a hugely complex universe, you need a God. The Catholics love this guy and use his arguments themselves. Pantheists also like it. That is, people who say the universe is one thing, with that everything in that universe being connected. Therefore, the universe is God. But God is absolutely nothing like the human-invented God. God is ineffable. That is beyond our understanding, so it's not our job to worry too much about it or worship it or anything else. Just get on with living your good life. Pascal, though, is avoiding the other million or so gods that humans have invented. Just the Christian God for him. All this was in response to, oddly enough, a growing number of agnostics. Now, 20 or more versions of Christianity in Europe means the whole thing's become a bit hit and miss. Pick up the wrong form of Christianity and it's hell for you anyway, so why bother? But the downside that he ignores is that he wants us to give up our Sunday mornings to go to a boring old magic show with a bunch of Christians That's going to cost us 10% of our income. No, thank you, Pascal. Pascal also invented the first bus system in Paris. Thanks, Pascal. Hell died age 39. If the Christian God is real, then he did not like Pascal. Tuberculosis, stomach cancer, and a brain tumour, all combined to ensure a slow, agonising death at an early age. But I think we should get back to war. That is the fun of the 30 Years' War. The thing was pretty much over when Denmark got done, but then in came Gustavus Adolphus in Sweden. He did pretty well until he got lost behind enemy lines and was killed. He was 37 and his heir was his six-year-old daughter. The mum was Maria Eleonora of Brandenburg, who had a serious case of postnatal depression, so the nobles formed a regency council, leaving mum out. Protestant states want the Swedish army to keep up the good fight, so we'll form another league and promise to pay them. Promises made, but they may not be kept. Richelieu will say, hey, France will send its subsidies for the Swedish army that it's currently paying to this nice new league instead of direct to Sweden. Johann George of Saxony will say, oh, look, I'm out, I'm over this ship. Swedes will come in and sweet talk Johann George into coming back in. Johann George is a power player, so the Empire mighty General Wallenstein will sneak guys in to make a separate treaty with him. That allows Wallenstein time to get himself organised to smash the Swedes. In he goes to smash the Swedes and take back Swedish-held territory, along with about 8,000 prisoners. Then he'll start raiding into Johann George territory to convince Johann George to sign peace treaties. Meanwhile, in other international news, Venice has a very nasty dose of the plague, with about a third of the population dying. And the church is having a big push against the advance of science by having Galileo in for a little chat. They'll let him off in 1992. Obviously, a long time after he's dead, but yeah, they will drop the charges by then. Oh, more world news. Boston. And a group of English colonialists are founding a town. First governor, John Winthrop, called it a city upon a hill. That means it's the new Jerusalem. Going to the approved magic show on Sunday is compulsory, as is training in scripture. Sin will be punished with a public whipping, certainly on the cards for naughty sinners. A strict moral code will be enforced, and anybody not being really truly into Puritanism will be punished and booted out. In short, Boston at the moment is hell. But our humans are waking up to this religious stuff. Doesn't matter whether you're Puritan, Catholic or Muslim, for that to matter. It's the same stuff, but each one wants to have its own rules and systems for making you boo-hoo-hoo if you break one of these stupid rules. Roger Williams, who said he was a Puritan, was found to be too tolerant. Maybe he got that point about the difference being just a bunch of man-made rules. He'll be booted out of Salem in Massachusetts and say, fine, I'll found my own town. Here we get Providence, Rhode Island, as a place for lovers of peace, love and littles. What were his tolerant views, you're wondering? Well, he wants to learn the language of the Native Americans. He wants slavery abolished, and he thinks freedom of religion is a good idea. After all, that's what the colonialists were looking for. Roger had been a chaplain to William Masham, whose grandson was married to Damaris, Lady Masham. Mention that because Damaris was the love object of one of the family guests, who happened to be John Locke, our rather famous philosopher with his Life is Nasty, Brutish and Short. What is he good for? Absolutely nothing. The Spanish are in talks with Duke Max of Bavaria. They want the Spanish road between Italy and Spanish Netherlands back in their control. Off they go, only to run into the Swedish army, who will push back so hard, the Swedes will get control of Regensburg in Bavaria. Big blow to the Emperor and also to Duke Max, who used to own Regensburg. The Emperor will have to get Wallenstein back on the case, even though he may be rather afraid of Wallenstein. Emperor Ferdinand to Wallenstein, go and get Regensburg back. Wallenstein will say, sure, but first he'll get the officers to take an oath of loyalty to him. Wallenstein. Yeah. The emperor won't like that, so he'll say, revise that oath so the guys are only loyal to you while they're in imperial service. That will be a no from Wallenstein. I don't know. These oaths seem to be about as binding as wet tissue paper. Solid as runny custard. 18th of February 1634, and orders are in that Wallenstein is to be stripped of his command and all officers transferred to Archduke Ferdinand, son of the emperor. And there you go. Their oaths to Wallenstein are immediately forgotten, and off they go, taking most of the troops with them. Off goes Wallenstein to make a deal with the Swedes to take him on as a brilliant general. But 7 days after being sacked, Wallenstein and those soldiers who had stayed with him will all be killed by imperial troops. Well, actually, I think they were Irish and Scottish. The emperor has lost his best general. Saxony and Brandenburg are both totally over this devastating war and will look to make a deal with the empire. Wallenstein will be replaced by yet another Ferdinand. This one is the King of Hungary, who will want to combine his forces with, would you believe it, Cardinal Ferdinand, another Ferdinand, the Infante of Spain. Yes, right, prince that's got a cardinal gig. They will go and get Regensburg back, then start clearing that road between the lowlands and Italy. Then they cop a nice windfall. The Swedes had decided to have two leaders of their army. Total different idea. These two guys have decided they'll run the army on alternate days. They will march on Nordlingen, where the dual command thingy finds them in total disarray. By the time they sorted themselves out, Spanish imperial reinforcements had arrived and are nicely organised. 27th of August 1634, Battle of Nordlingen. Team Empire will lose 3,500 guys, Team Sweden and the latest whatever league it is will lose 20,000 with 8,000 captured, and Sweden no longer has an army. Off go the Spanish imperial troops, just taking stuff and splitting the Protestant northern provinces from the Protestant southern provinces. Team Protestant has only one option left, and that will be the Frenchies. Richelieu can dictate whatever terms he likes. They won't do much good. March 1635, and the Spanish will take Trier's and capture the Archbishop Elector. That can open up another war. That's what we want. France versus Spain is now official, and that will stay that way for 14 years, distracting both sides from Germany. This whole thing had really blown up because of the Edict of Restitutions, where Protestants had to give up their churchy lands to Catholics. The emperor had reached a preliminary agreement with Johann George of Saxony, but the sticking point is that edict. Ferdinand likes the edict, but he can see it's a problem. And even his churchy guys are saying, hey, let it go, mate. He will get in top 20 theologians who will say, sure, God will be okay with that. 30th of May, 1635, Peace of Prague, where Ferdinand can't totally let go of his edict, but it will be suspended for 40 years. The can has been kicked down the road for someone else to sort out. Lands get swapped around. Some Catholics will have to be Protestants again, but in return, these particular Protestants promise not to fight the empire, make no treaties, and in need fight for the empire. That treaty will be open to all Protestant states along with an amnesty and a restoration of titles. With one exception. If you guess that the Palatinate was not offered in that deal, then well done. The only one that won't be going back. Only one of the Protestant princes won't sign, and this is William of Hesse, who said, no need, we've always been neutral. At this stage, then, the 30 Years' War has been going on for about 17 years. But this ends the kind of civil war aspect of it. There's still France and Sweden, and they will be back. While all these German guys were signing off on treaties, Boston established the Latin School of Boston, the very first public school in America. Cardinal Richelieu established the Académie Française to give a home to people who had been hanging out in the Hôtel de Rambouillet. These were the best and brightest minds in France. Their job is to purify the French language, give it rules like grammar, handy stuff, and make it fit for literary and scientific purposes. It's a copy of an idea that started in Florence, which unified the Italian language using the Tuscan dialect. I keep getting distracted from the wall. The emperor made a deal with the Protestants, but not all of his Catholic allies were happy about it. You can always bribe them, like Duke Max of Bavaria will score the emperor's daughter as a bribe, and his brother can be a bishop, plus his troops, amalgamated into imperial forces, will have some autonomy in there. George Wilhelm of Bavaria wanted Pomerania, which was held by the Swedes. That then will guarantee that the war will continue. Richelieu had got Sweden involved in the first place by arranging a truce between Sweden and Poland. The truce is up, and Richelieu doesn't want Sweden being distracted by Poland, so he'll arrange another 26-year truce there. Sweden was far weaker, so Poland got a good deal and decided immediately to head to Germany. Saxony will declare war on Sweden, looking to cut them off from the sea. Sweden will repel the Saxons. France will then open triple fronts, the Lowlands, Spain and Italy, and will fail in all three. Without the Frenchies, Bernard Saxe-Weimar will have to retreat and the empire will take stuff from him. Bernard will do a deal with France, which means he's reneging on deals he'd done with the Swedes. Ah, these guys are such dicks, are they not? We're in 1636 and the war is now totally bogged down and going nowhere. It's just armies marching around the place with the smash and destroy policies. The Cardinal Infante Ferdinand will march from the lowlands invading France and it'll take a lot of effort to push him back. But the Swedes are getting organised again. February 1637 and Emperor Ferdinand will die, so it'll be his son, oddly enough, named Ferdinand. Ferdinand III, he's now in charge. This period, though, is really just going from here to there, with one side having a great win and then the other side having a great win, and repeat and repeat and repeat. Plus the odd bit of extra misery, like summer 1639 when plague goes through Bernard of Saxe-Weimar's army and goes through Bernard himself. His son will take over and he just wants to see who's going to pay him the most. Ferdinand, Sweden or the Frenchies? It'll be the Frenchies, and it'll make Ferdinand very unhappy. 1639 is the year that the British East India Company bought a shitty little village in India, which will become Madras. Back in England, astronomer Jeremiah Horrocks had done some nice astrophysics, demonstrating that the moon moves around the Earth in an elliptical orbit. I didn't say that well. In an elliptical orbit. See, if I speak slowly, I can sometimes do it. Having done that, he worked out the transit of Venus. His prediction was that it would occur at 3 p.m. on the 24th of November 1639. He just needs to prove it, so he'll make a helioscope, which is a thingy that you use to observe the sun without the need to go blind. A telescope is then used to project the image onto the helioscope. 3 p.m. comes and nothing. Fuck it. 3:15 and bingo. We see a small black dot transiting across the sun. He's cracked it. And that Académie Française has just knocked out the first Frenchy dictionary. And lots of Germans are dying. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. By 1640, the German big dicks are totally over it. They really want peace. Shame it's only year 22 of the 30 Years' War. Still, over in the lowlands, it's year 72 of the 80 Years' War, so there is that. Diet of Regensburg with all sorts of safe conduct passes handed around. The idea is that the Peace of Prague could grow if a broader amnesty was announced. Invites went out to even our Elizabeth Stuart. She won't go. Dickhead. It'll kick off well with a general amnesty, then get on to what is needed for a general settlement. Swedish propaganda pamphlet will hit town. It says that the imperial constitution doesn't allow for tons of stuff the emperors have been doing. And the young big dicks will be buying this stuff. Then Fred Wilhelm, the young elector of Brandenburg, will say, "This is all shit, and anyway, I've made a separate truce with Sweden, so I'm off." and the young big dicks will go with him. Even so, the guys to the left will make some traction. France and Sweden will renew their treaty and invite Ferdinand to peace talks in Westphalia. Tricky, so it will be needed to be done in two separate sessions. Ferdinand and Spain, or we might say Team Habsburg there, will meet with the Swedes, the Dutch, and the Protestant princes. Then Ferdinand and Spain, Team Habsburg, will meet with the Frenchies and the Catholic princes. Sounds good to Ferdinand, but he knows if he could actually unite the empire first, then he would get a way better deal. So he wants another meeting with the empire types, the Catholics and the Protestants in the German states. None of this stuff caused any sort of ceasefire. The Swedes will start their summer campaign, doing well, but look, they're getting close to Vienna. So Ferdinand's got to send an army to beat them back, which they do for a bit. Sweden will be on the retreat, but it's that old pretend runaway, so they will turn suddenly and do the surprise motherfucker on the Imperial Army. Half that Imperial Army will be off to heaven. Back to world news, and Portugal has finally shaken off its Spanish masters and become independent again. In England, our civil war is getting ready to kick off. This was very big news. European kings won't like the look of that at all. Plenty of historians see it as the idea that will catch on in France and America, which will eventually lead us to the marvellous democracy, so we can all go and fight and die for democracy. Descartes will publish his Meditations on Philosophy, which, so far, has never been out of print. Never ever. I like Descartes. It's about the first thing that philosophy students get to study. He's advanced the theory of the structure and properties of the material universe. Newton is coming up in about 50 years to supersede it, but it's very helpful to get us to Newton. China and its shit and disaster this year. Earthquakes, epidemics, floods, famine, civil unrest and uprisings. 1641 and disease will race through the place. By now, China have got very crowded cities, and very crowded cities are things that diseases love, and those cities will lose around half their population. We don't know exactly what that disease was, but it seems to have something to do with the Chinese fondness of living in close proximity with all sorts of animals. Yeah, does that sound familiar? Richelieu is dead, and that could have been a disaster for the peace talks, but fortunately Mazarin smoothly took over. The empire had also deferred for a year or so because of their internal disorder. Louis XIII can die, leaving France to baby Sun King with Queen Anne as regent. That, in case I've never mentioned it, is Anne of Austria, a Habsburg, and sister of Spanish Phil. Yeah, I had mentioned it before, but I thought you might have forgot. Bingo, says Spain and the Empire. France will be on Team Us. But Anne is totally fixed on being on Team Louis XIV, so no change to French foreign policy. Frenchy forces march into Germany with the usual story. Early success, big dust-up, repeat leaving corpses of our comrades behind. Young Turk, Fred Wilhelm, will also cop it from the Bavarians, who are on a roll. 1644, and it's going splendidly well for Bavaria, but here comes the Frenchies again to give them a belting. And so it goes, or continues, in a circular motion, with armies ravaging crops pretty constantly. Believe it or believe it, the Swedes, in the meantime, have decided to have a go at the Danes. At least that will get the troops out of Germany. Swedish allies, the Dutchies, will bring their navy in to attack Danish ports and islands. Danes will send the help-wanted message to Ferdinand, but his troops will be a bit late. Denmark has lost Jutland, and Christian of Denmark will have to make peace. While Ferdinand's troops were heading off to help Christian, the Hungarians will rebel, and Ferdinand needs those troops back quick smart. Great. Those troops will have to march back through lands where all the food is gone, and they'll be harassed all the way by Swedish troops, and about 9 in 10 won't make it. Ferdinand will have to make peace with Hungary, particularly because they had just done a deal with the Ottoman Empire. Ferdinand will cobble together another army to go and belt up the Swedes, but it will be the Swedes who do the kicking, and that's another imperial army gone. Now the Swedes are moving in on Vienna, and Ferdinand's got to run away. Great time for the Hungarians to break their treaty and get stuck back in. Ferdinand is fucked. Yes, he is well and truly fucked. The Swedes could take him easy peasy, so they won't do that. They'll say, oh, let's take this other town first, which will be a fail. But that's given Ferdinand time to cobble again yet another army. The Swedes will see their stuff up and retreat to Bohemia. Frenchies, though, have decided to back up the Swedes' victory and attack Bavaria. They think this is going to be easy peasy, so they'll split their army, with half going into Bavaria with the idea of being an occupying force. Bavarians will say, fuck you, Frenchies, and give them a good kicking. Swedes will then come in and give the Bavarians a good kicking. Swedes will head towards Saxony. Johann George will say, no need for Biff, I surrender, and you can have free passage through Saxony. 1645, and Saxony is out of the war. If you've forgotten, all that Biff has been going on while we were organising peace talks at Westphalia. Yeah, stop organising and start doing it, mate. Frenchy Mazarin will send two ambassadors in April 1644. These two guys just happen to detest each other, so they'll spend most of their time trying to undermine each other. It doesn't matter at the moment that they're doing that, because the big hairy deal right now is the protocol bullshit. Who should sit where? Who should speak when? What title should we use when addressing them? Oh, dear me. 8 months later, and we're at the stage when the big dicks submit their various demands. Preliminary demands at this stage, so of course they're all pretty outrageous. Ferdinand has had his big powwow with the Germans and made a big fucking compromise. Hard to believe. The German delegation will be Catholics and Protestants 50-50. Instead of the usual 60-40. That's a big reform, and it's rather promising. Finally, 1 year and 2 months after those peace talks have started, we're all ready to talk about peace, the real peace. The opening offer is that everything should go back to how it was in 1618 when hostilities started. All lands go back to those who held them then. And shit, Elizabeth might get the Palatinate back. Taxes to be determined by imperial diets and not just the emperor. Various parts of the empire to have autonomy in making alliances between themselves and with foreign powers. France, Sweden and some smaller parts of the empire to be compensated for their costs. Swedes will toss in that they want Calvinism recognised as a religion. I think I know what Ferdinand will say, but it'll take months for him to say it. No way, get fuck off. Okay, that's all been rejected, so now the bargaining will get going. Swedes want lots of stuff, Frenchies want not so much stuff. Empire will agree to not as much as the Frenchies want, but the agreement is worded in a way that we are all nicely uncertain to exactly what is being given. It's serious negotiations. But, of course, the fighting is continuing. Empire will beat the Swedes out of Bohemia, and Swedes will just take another place. Frenchies will join the Swedes and march on Bavaria. Empire is in the wrong place to stop them. In they go, to devastate lots of Bavaria. Still war, but we should have a squeeze at what's going on in the 80 Years' War. The duchies have just had win after win after win against the Spanish in the Americas and the East Indies. Their sugar plantations in Brazil mean that they're the largest sugar producer in the world. This is down to the activities of the Dutch East India Company and their hard men. It's better than that. Their naval fleet under the command of Martin Tromp, likewise, has just been unbeatable. The Dutchies have got the best navy in the world. They are top of the pops in international trade and they are making shit tons of money. Plenty to buy in mercenaries. On top of that, Spain has been fighting its war against the Frenchies, plus they've been in Germany. They haven't recovered the road to Italy. Flanders has been isolated, so the only way they can buy and sell is to pay huge taxes to the Dutch. Spanish soldiers aren't getting their pay and are deserting. And even if they do get money, that money comes from Spain and it's spent in Flanders. That's no good to the Spanish economy. In short, the Spanish are fucked. And that's it. Peace. 80 years with about 100,000 Dutchies dead, and who the fuck knows how many Spanish died for this crap. The Dutchies didn't get everything back, so it's going to be new lines on the map. The present-day Netherlands will be made then, with the Spanish territory becoming Belgium and Luxembourg. The Dutchies don't care. Lots of overseas stuff they'd taken will still be theirs in this deal. So it's peace in the lowlands after 80 years, and isn't that great? Well, it is, but of course, there'll be an immediate political crisis, and things can be chaos as usual, and it's going to get worse. But enough of that for now. 30 years war again. The empire, like Spain, is pretty fucked. It is dark days for Team Habsburg, and Ferdinand will be doing plenty of deals at those peace talks. Frenchies are totally happy, but of course Spanish forces from the lowlands have just been freed up following the end of the 80 Years' War. Mazarin will order his general in Germany to head off to counter the Spanish threat, but his best troops, Bernard of Saxe-Weimar's guys, will say, "No way, mate. We don't fight outside Germany. Not going." Ferdinand is having the same problem, telling the Bavarian cavalry to come and help him with the Swedes, and that'll be a no. Max of Bavaria will break the deal he had with the Frenchies, so those cavalry can go and help out. All these little deals being made and then broken slow down the big picture peace deal. 1648, and Frenchy and Swedish forces will go to Bavaria to punish Max. They'll do well. Then Ferdinand will get the former leader of the Spanish Lowlands forces to come in and stop them. Okay, they've stopped them. Now what? Well, it'll be very nasty for the common smellies. While that was going on, imperial forces were pushing towards Prague, doing the exact same thing. Smash, burn, loot, rape, kill. Rebellion in France, and everyone somehow simultaneously says that is it. We have all had enough. 24th of October 1648, in they come and say, "Where do I sign?" The 30 Years' War is over. What is good for? Absolutely nothing. Well, Frankie goes to Hollywood. It was good for about 8 million dead, of which 6.5 million were civilians. Germany's been smashed up big time. Land transfers are going off everywhere. The Palatinate remains split, with neither bit going to Elizabeth. The constitution of the empire has been loosened, but the rewrite was a bad job and not terribly coherent. Calvinism will be recognised. Money changed hands. Nobody particularly will come out feeling like they're a winner. And fair enough, it's been a total shit show and a very convoluted tale. The Pope will chip in on reading the treaty with a press release. The treaty is null, void, invalid, iniquitous, unjust, damnable, reprobate, inane, empty of meaning and effect for all time. When I say a press release, I mean a papal bull, a document that was greatly feared in the past. But hey, we all know the Pope needs to go with the program and understand this Protestant stuff in its very many forms. He's now here. And it's staying. We can't just fight perpetual wars trying to kill each other over the magic show. There wouldn't be any peasants left to grow our food and clean our dunny. Civic leaders know that the war over the right Christianity in Europe has ended with this treaty. The Peace of Westphalia, of course, did not bring permanent peace. We know these guys. We know our mighty leaders who are always and perpetually stirring up trouble that leads to wars.
A toast! Peace in Europe!
Peace in Europe!
Excellent.
Excuse me.
Oh, what is it what? Now? Why are you interrupting?
What? Forgive me, Ambassador, but what about Luxembourg?
He's right, nobody owns Luxembourg.
France, I thought you owned Luxembourg.
No, we thought it was Dutch.
Sweden?
No, we thought it was Belgium.
England?
Well, we just knew it was on the continent and didn't give a toss, really.
It looks as if Luxembourg has slipped through our net, doesn't it? Well, we've got a country going up for grabs. Anybody yeah. interested?
Is it Protestant?
Mostly Catholic, I believe.
Let's just use it for storage.
Okay, good, good. No, that's good.
No, it's not good. Someone's got to take it. Come on, who wants it? What's it consist of?
The small state of Luxembourg is a charming reminder of how Europe used to be. Plague victims crawl elegantly down its dung-filled streets, greasing the way with pus from their buboes, while at least 2 children a week are burned as the devil in the handsome market square.
What it has done is bring a new understanding of the international and national order. The emperor's power has been greatly diminished. We have about 300 states in the empire, with the new rule being one state leader should not interfere with the operations in another state. If that state wants to turn to whatever religion it wants, then that's their business. Sweden and France have further reduced the size of the empire by about 40,000 square miles. Good news for Austria, Bavaria, and Brandenburg, which will soon be called Prussia, is that they are freed from imperial control and can become major growth states. They can hit the big time, like those Italian city-states. On the downside, giving control of all these states to the state leaders will bring a rise in nationalism, which always seems to end in tears. 1 in 3 Germans is dead. In some areas, the death rate could be as high as 75%. People fleeing one area could bring disease with them and spread it to those who took them in. 1,500 towns, 2,000 villages and 2,000 castles are gone, and that, my dear listener, is just what the Swedes did on their own. They kindly counted them for us. The population went a bit crazy, leading to a big rise in stupid shit like witch hunts, which are now gone. There's too few people left to be setting them on fire. Pestilence and famine was all round the place. Local economies collapsed. There's been widespread social dislocation. Taxes have been horrendous and riots occurred frequently. Religious influence on politics has been severely weakened. World news, Istanbul has become the largest city in the world, taking over from Beijing. In England, Charles has been defeated. Parliament decided to let Jews back to England, and oddly enough, France said, hey, that's a good idea, so they're back in France too. Descartes will die in Sweden. William II of Orange and Princess Mary will have a boy, William, who'll definitely be in our story. 10-year-old Louis XIV will crap himself with the civil war breaking out in France, just as his uncle Charles found himself arrested in England. And so, my dear listener, this episode has nearly done my head in. Big, complex story done. But I've been a tad bothered ever since we met Pascal. I can't help thinking of you at the disco being chatted up by some terribly attractive human, and you're thinking this will end up in a nice bit of rumpy pumpy. That person says, have you heard of Pascal? And you say, yeah, some dickhead with a stupid idea of the proof of God. This would be a huge mistake and possibly take that rumpy pumpy off the cards. Pascal was a total genius, specialised in maths. His dad was a supervisor of taxes, a tax accountant. So Pascal invented the calculator, a fair dinkum mechanical calculator. He had to shrink and adapt a lantern gear for the thing. It adds, subtracts and multiplies. And in addition, over in England we've had the slide rule invented that does way more complex things. But Dad was very pleased, as was Louis XIV. 9 of Pascal's calculators still exist. Now the thing with the proof of God was more about calculations he made to get there. It was a risk and reward calculation done with real numbers. He invented probability theory, which influenced modern economics and made professional gamblers very happy. There's way more than that to him, so please don't write him off as a wanker. Yeah, the nimble fingers of Tal Farlow there to get us into some historical fiction. And this week I had a crack at a corker of a novel by Aussie author Elliot Perlman, The Street Sweeper. Remarkable book. It's about life being nasty, brutish and short for Jewish people in Poland in the 1930s and 40s. And just to make it a bit worse, it's also referencing a bit of black history in the USA, which is also rather disturbing. But the whole thing is actually set in modern day with a number of characters who are exploring this stuff. As I say, there's a number of characters, but don't let that put you off. This guy is very good at his job in writing, and so he will develop the characters very much, and you really get to know the people. As I was reading through it, I had a feeling that at the end he would give us some sort of an idea how much was made up and what was actually drawn from the record. And as I went, I was hoping more and more he was going to tell me some of that Jewish and black stuff was made up. But no, it's only the stuff that's happening now. He's got fictional characters now. The stuff he references in the past all happened. And just to prove his point, he listed a bloody heap of books where he got these records from. This is a harrowing read, but very worthwhile. The Street Sweeper by Elliot Perlman, I recommend it. But not if you're feeling down. For us, though, it's just a matter of what we go out with. And the action at the moment on the planet is in Ukraine. And that's a very complicated story of how we got to where we are. And, of course, that complicated story is not given anywhere in the Western media. It's just basically a black and white issue for them. Russia bad, Ukraine good, yeah. And it's not like that, of course, but I'm not going into that right now. Because the actions in Ukraine and been talking about a novel about Jews, why don't we go out with a Jewish song from the Ukraine? Goodbye, Odessa. Hope to see you next time. Bye. Прощай, Одесса, прощай, ты бребята, кричи не секунду.